And welcome back to Reedwood. And we're just grateful to have this time to hear something new in word and in song. And what gifts, such gifts those are to have that. Newcomers, welcome to Reedwood Friends. And we're just so glad that you are here with us to worship in word and in song. And well, I don't want to take too much more time, and I just wanted to kind of segue and to welcome our guests to this time and in this hour of worship. But welcome you guys, and I'm just going to go ahead and hand things off here to you. Daniel, good to see you.
Thank you. Good morning, friends. Let me just add my welcome to Reedwood Friends. For me, of course, this is a bit of a homecoming. This is my home congregation, my home church family, so it's good to be home. But enough of that. We're here to think this morning about the Bible and the blues. Now, what in the world does the blues have to do with the Bible? Well, in the next hour, we're going to be engaged in a little experiment together. It's part of an experiment that I've been engaged in now for the last 7 or 8 years. And so I hope that in this hour we can show you what does the blues have to do with the Bible. Now let me give you a little bit of introduction, some historical context to what we're going to be doing. I'm a professor of Old Testament. This year is my 30th year of teaching Old Testament at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. And the period of the Old Testament that I am especially interested in is the period of time just about 600 years before the time of Jesus. Now, some rather catastrophic events happened in those years, 600 some years before the time of Jesus. The massive Babylonian Empire, led by the legendary Nebuchadnezzar, attacked Jerusalem and exiled as prisoners of war thousands of Judeans from Jerusalem itself, but also from the Judean countryside, who were marched across what is today Israel, Syria, Iraq, and marched down into what is today southern Iraq and forcibly resettled in what we now know to be prisoner of war villages that the Babylonian Empire maintained. So the Hebrew prisoners of war were forcibly resettled in what is today near Baghdad. We call these events the Babylonian exile. And these horrendous events are described towards the end of the historical books of 2 Kings, but also reflected in the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel, reflected partly in the prophet Isaiah, and probably now we're beginning to understand are events probably reflected in a good part of the first books of the Bible as well. And many of us even think that the story of Adam and Eve exiled from the garden might be a reference, in fact, to these catastrophic events. How huge was this impact on biblical thinking? Brothers and sisters, it was massive. And it continued to impact the writers and thinkers of the Bible well into the New Testament. The book of Revelation refers to the Roman Empire as Babylon. And the little Christian book that we call 1 Peter begins by saying to the churches in the exile. And that little letter ends by saying, greet your fellow exiles in Babylon. So the thinking about being exiles makes a deep stamp on the thinking of the Bible. But one of the books that I confess, up until recently, I just didn't pay that much attention to. One of the books is a little book of only 5 chapters called The Book of Lamentations. Now, this little book has actually attracted a great deal of new interest lately, and we're going to find out some of the reasons why that's the case. Now, I referred to this morning as a kind of biblical experiment. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the fact that I'm not up here alone is your first hint. But before I introduce my partners in this program this morning, a little bit more introduction. Today, we want to understand a little bit more about that little book of 5 chapters called the Book of Lamentations. And we're going to try and understand that little book by drawing on a modern parallel from American history and culture, and specifically today, drawing on that rich culture of African Americans. Now, among the many precious gifts of African American culture to the whole world, much less the United States, and especially, of course, to American society, is music. Music in many different forms and styles. It's critical that we remember, of course, that this music was entirely given to us and to the rest of the world out of great pain and suffering from African Americans as a people, and our appreciation for their many gifts to us should always be accompanied by an appreciation of their continued endurance of often terrible treatment. Now, I am myself very interested in one of those musical gifts known as the spirituals. That early Christian music that was composed entirely anonymously in the period of slavery. It is a deeply devotional music. It's at times joyful as well as meditative. Now, spirituals, we know, came from slavery, because the first articles that were written by white folks who began to hear the spirituals was written actually in the displaced persons' camps right immediately after the Civil War. So some of the officers, the Union officers who were in charge of these large numbers of former slaves in these displaced persons' camps, already in the 1860s were printing articles about this new music that they'd never heard before, that they were hearing from the former slaves in the camps. So we know that spirituals came from slavery. And spirituals, as any African American pastor will tell you, is what we might call today the mother of gospel music, that exhilarating and joyful and expressive music of Christian faith that burst into existence in this country in the 1930s, largely through the genius of one man, the Reverend Thomas Dorsey. Thomas Dorsey is, I must tell you, one of my American heroes. He is not only the writer of probably the greatest gospel tune of all time, Take My Hand, Precious Lord. He was also a choir director. He founded the National Convention of Gospel Choirs and Choruses, and he was the tutor of the greatest gospel singer of all time, Mahalia Jackson. Gospel music, of course, is still very much with us, and it has branched into so many different directions within and outside the African-American Christian experience, but it's good for us to remember that the birth of gospel came from two parents. So if we all know that the spirituals are the loving mother of gospel music, today, this morning, we're here to restore some honor to the maligned and often ignored controversial father of gospel music. You see, there was another musical form that was essential to the emergence of gospel. Central to gospel, we said, was the Reverend Thomas Dorsey. He was so influential that gospel music was originally referred to as Dorsey's. He was that critical transitional figure. And here's the key. You see, the Reverend Dorsey wasn't always known as Reverend Dorsey. In his younger days, Thomas Dorsey was the dapper blues piano man backing up one of the greatest early blues singers of all time, Ma Rainey and her band. In those days, he was known as Georgia Tom. He was, as we would say today, a blues man. He played all over the country, based in Chicago. Dorsey, you see, brought his blues background to his Christian conversion, and the rest is gospel history. But what has all of this, as interesting as it is, what has all this got to do with Lamentations and the blues? How did we get here? Well, it isn't too difficult to explain. Arguably, one of the most emotionally wrenching books of the entire Bible are the five chapters that we know today as the Book of Lamentations. They are the cries of anguish from the ruins of defeated Jerusalem after the devastation of Nebuchadnezzar's armies who ravaged Jerusalem and the surrounding villages of Judah. But you see, they're more than just simply the first horrified screams after those dreadful attacks. They're poetry. And as we shall soon learn, they are quite unusual poems because they are very carefully and artfully composed. So, some years ago, I was reading a bit on the blues musical tradition when it suddenly occurred to me, if the blues comes from the suffering and pain of a people, then Lamentations, in a profound sense, is Hebrew blues. So then, are the blues African-American Lamentations? That's what brings us here this morning. I think we can learn a great deal together by thinking about the Book of Lamentations and also at the same time thinking about the musical medium that is uniquely American, the blues. Now, when I started this some years ago, I have to admit I didn't know anything about blues. I kind of had a sense of what it was. But one thing I have learned, my brothers and sisters, and I learned that in the pews of this church, and that is, there's no point in just talking about the blues, just like there's no point in just talking about Jesus. Unless it's part of your experience, it's just talk. So I have enlisted some help. I am pleased to introduce to you this morning my Reedwood family, the First Lady of Portland Blues, my new friend, the great LaRonda Steele. Together with LaRonda is Edward Snyder. Welcome, Edward. Edward, as I understand, you're a Portland boy.
Born and raised.
Yep, like me, and southeast.
Yeah, further out.
Southeast, okay. There we go. Edward is the owner of Gresham Music, and he has been playing now for 6 to 7 years with LaRonda.
Oh, yeah, LaRonda.
Yep.
50 years.
And I am pleased to say that CDs are available after today out in the foyer for $10, including a CD of LaRonda and Ed. Together with Edward and LaRonda, we're going to be taking a journey this morning called The Bible and the Blues. So let's get oriented. Just as it is absolutely clear that we cannot understand either the blues or lamentations in the Bible without some historical context, let's get started. Let's talk about the Book of Lamentations first. Now, the Bible teaches us that the Israelite people were only too familiar with suffering, and often at the hands of major military powers surrounding them. In fact, biblical history, and therefore so much of our Bible, is built around three historical crises. Egyptian slavery, that begins the story, followed by two horrendous conquests. The northern kingdom at the hands of the Assyrian Empire, and the southern kingdom at the hands of the Babylonian Empire. And we can add a fourth crisis to that because, of course, the entire New Testament was written under brutal Roman occupation of Palestine. All of these crises, none, I would argue, compares for its impact on the Bible as that attack on Jerusalem from the Babylonians. What was the nature of this crisis? Well, scholars tell us that the destruction of Jerusalem and surrounding areas of Babylon was the most devastating event in Old Testament history. That's quite a claim. Let me make it again. The most devastating event in biblical history. And it was devastating. One historian concludes, the evidence supports the hypothesis that Jerusalem remained desolate throughout this entire period. The great Israeli archaeologist Professor Oded Lipschitz estimates that the entire population of Judah was about 100,000 before the Babylonian crisis and drops to 30,000 after the crisis, a 70% decline. Well, where do we hear the cries of the human crisis? Of the devastation of the peoples of Scripture? Where can we even begin to hear the cries of those who suffered the Assyrian and Babylonian attacks? Well, I've learned one place is the little book of Lamentations. In five short chapters, this little book tells us about the siege of Jerusalem, famine in the city, the flight of the army and the king, the burning of the palace, the breaching of the walls, the exile of many Judeans, the looting of the temple, execution of leaders, and the collapse of any foreign help. But of course, it's not just these historical pieces of information we're interested in. In Lamentations, we hear a human cry of pain. Listen to the opening verses. How lonely sits the city that was once full of people. How like a widow she has become. She that was great among the nations, she that was a princess among the provinces, has become a vassal. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has no one to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile with suffering and hard servitude. She lives now among the nations and finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. Thank you.
Me and my baby was talking. What he said is true. Seem like times are getting tougher, just like they was in 1932. You don't have no job. All our bills are due. Now tell me, baby, what are we gonna do? Tough times. Tough times are here once more. I had a good job, worked many long hours a week. They had a big layoff, and they got poor me. I'm broke and disgusted, can't find a job. Nothing in my house to eat. I cry, oh Lord, tough times. Tough times are here once more. Oh, yeah. Went down to the grocery store just to get a little more food to eat. The man said, wait a minute, how do we stand? I'm sorry to tell you, I'm far behind. Lord, I know we're falling, falling on tough times, tough times. Tough times are here once more, yeah. I'm here to tell you people, if you ain't got no money, life ain't worth living no more, no
So we understand now some of the context for reading the book of Lamentations. What about a context for listening carefully to the blues, especially the early Delta blues that arose in the Mississippi Delta area of Mississippi and Arkansas as the river heads down towards the Gulf of Mexico? It's just as important to know something about the history of the blues as it is to listen to history when we read Lamentations. Professor David Davis is one of our most distinguished historians of slavery in America, and he writes the following. By 1820, nearly 10 million slaves had departed from Africa to the New World, as opposed to 2.6 million whites. By 1820, African slaves constituted 80% of the enormous population that sailed toward the Americas from 1760 to 1820. This immigration flow included 8 African slaves for every European. Davis summarizes, slavery became, as he says, the dark underside of the American dream. And lest we confidently blame only the southern states for this dark underside of American history, Davis reminds us that New World slavery in the Americas began in the northern colonies. By the mid-18th century, he writes, slaves did a third of all physical labor In New York City, by 1750, slaves were 34% of the population of Brooklyn. How central was slavery to the American economy? Davis notes that by 1840, the southern states produced 60% of the world's cotton. Until the Civil War, cotton accounted for over half the value of all American exports. It was a stimulant to northern industry. New York City did the paperwork, the insurance, and the shipping. Now, we often believe, don't we, that all of this ended with the Civil War, but we know today this isn't true. Racism continued and continues to be a virulent presence in American society, not only directed toward African Americans, but many other cultures and peoples in this land. So where did the blues come from? After the Civil War, although slavery had ended, new economic systems of oppression and discrimination replaced it. In the Mississippi Delta, when all the trees were cleared, it was discovered, almost by accident, that cotton grew easily. Black families moved there to try to work plots of land. The promise was the famous 40 acres and a mule. But Southern whites owned all the equipment and all the seed and charged such high rent that African American families were virtually economically enslaved. It was called sharecropping, and it was almost as effective as slavery in holding back Black American progress. It was the crushing disappointment that freedom and equality did not come out of the Civil War that gave rise to the blues. And especially in places where there was supposed to be such economic opportunity, the Mississippi Delta. So the places in the South with the greatest promise produced the most gut-wrenching disappointment. And it was the Delta, especially, that gave rise to most of the earliest blues musicians. It's precisely that period that we are interested in. So when all of the Mississippi Delta was finally brought under cultivation, the amount of land working by sharecropping there was 80%. The system was known as late as 1935 as the halves, because half of the crop went to the white owner for supplies, and all loans could be paid at a rate of 30 to 40% interest. Riley King's grandmother was a sharecropper who worked the system as recently as 1939. We know Riley King better as Blues Boy King, or BB for short. It doesn't take much imagination to consider what kind of impact this level of poverty would have had on family structures among African American sharecroppers. Davis writes about life in the Delta. Black life, he says, was a nightmare of rootlessness and self-destruction from which Black America still hasn't fully awakened. He's writing this in the 1990s, by the way. Most marriages were common law and understood to be temporary, hopelessly in debt to a landowner. The entire family might steal away by night to another plantation, where as likely as not, they'd find themselves in the same situation. The man of the family might flee on his own. Someone who considered himself a family man might sire many children to produce more workers, and then the price of raising the children. Tuberculosis was rampant. Murder was a fact of life. Loneliness from broken families trying to work more than one job became a very central theme of blues lyrics.
sitting here a thousand miles from nowhere in my one-room country shack. Oh, Lord, I'm sitting here a thousand miles from nowhere in my one-room country shack. Oh, and my only worldly possessions is this 11-foot country gunny sack, yeah. I wake up every night around midnight. People, I just can't sleep no more, no. I wake up every night around midnight. People, I can't sleep no more. Only crickets, frogs keep me company, and the wind howling in my back door. Well, I'm leaving here early in the morning, and I'm just about to lose my mind. Lord, Lord, I'm leaving here early in the morning, just about to lose my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna find me a new companion. I don't care if he's deaf, dumb, or blind. Oh, every night I wake up about midnight, y'all. I can't sleep a wink at night. Every morning I wake up around midnight, and I can't sleep a wink at night. Well, I'm leaving here in the morning, and ooh, yeah.
Most Old Testament scholars believe that the biblical poetic form that we call lamentations was developed from a much shorter form known as a dirge. Now, there aren't many examples of this in the Bible, but there are a few. They're little short sentences, like Jeremiah 38, 22, "Your trusted friends have seduced you and have overcome you, and now your feet are stuck in the mud, they desert you." Or Amos 5, "Fallen no more to rise is maiden Israel, forsaken on her land with no one to raise her up." So a dirge, obviously, is a short statement of pathos, of emotion, and it often uses a comparison. He or she is like that. But many scholars believe that a dirge does not really expect a response. It's just simply a cry of sadness and mourning. So is the Book of Lamentations simply a series of dirges from an ancient practice of mourning? But you see, clearly the Book of Lamentations is not only that. They are fully formed poems that we now call laments. And a lament is a very sophisticated and complex poetic form. A lament is a poem that is usually much longer. And all scholars agree that a lament is not simply an expression of pain and emotion. A lament is a call to others, and especially a call to God to respond. Dr. Walter Brueggemann, one of our most important American Old Testament scholars, famously calls laments a kind of protest. He says, it's good to call on God, as well as to others, to respond to a tragedy. So what characterizes a lament? Well, virtually everybody agrees that a lament has to have four pieces. Number one, an address to God. A lament always begins, "Oh God!" So you're calling on God. Secondly, there's always a complaint, a description of distress, and it starts with questions like, why? Or how long? And then third, there is a plea and a petition. Please, God, change this. So that's one, two, and three. Here comes the controversial point four. An assurance that God has heard. Sometimes with even, thank you, God, for hearing my prayer. Now, I'll come back in a minute to why that's controversial. But you can hear all four of these pieces in laments that appear in the book of Psalms. Listen, for example, to Psalm 13. O Lord, how long will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I bear pain in my soul and have sorrow in my heart? All day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep the sleep of death, and my enemy will say, I have prevailed. But I trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. Did you hear all four pieces? So the important difference between a short dirge and a lament is that a lament expects a response from God. It expects God by actually thanking God ahead of time. So surprising is that last part of a lament, sort of pre-thanking God, that some have said, no, 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 surely that fourth point was only said much later when there was some sense of a response. Others say, no, that's part of faith, to anticipate that God has heard and God will answer in God's time. Finally, it's important to keep in mind that laments come to us in two forms, individual and communal. How do you recognize a communal lament? It's not too difficult. Listen to Psalm 60. O God, you have rejected us, broken our defenses. You have been angry, now restore us. You have caused the land to quake. You have torn it open. Repair the cracks in it, for it is tottering. You have made your people suffer hard things. You've given us wine to drink that has made us reel. You have set up a banner for those who fear you to rally to it. Give victory with your right hand and answer us so that those whom you love may be rescued. So, here is the question, my brothers and sisters. Are the lamentations in the Book of Lamentations and also in Psalms, are they read as an expression of hope or hopelessness? What does it mean to call on God? What might it mean to express hopelessness? Is it only an outcry of sadness? Or is Walter Brueggemann right? Is it also a protest against the conditions that we're living in?
Got me accused of peeping. I can't see a thing. Got me accused of petting. I can't even raise my hands. Bad luck. Bad luck is killing me. Well, I just can't stand no more, no more. Can't stand no more this third degree. Got me accused of murder. I never harmed a man. Got me accused of forgery. I can't even write my name. Bad, bad luck. Bad luck is killing me. Just can't stand it, people. I can't stand no more of this third degree. Let me tell you something else. They got me accused of taxes. I ain't even got a dime. Got me accused of children. And I know ain't none of them mine. Oh, bad luck. Bad luck is killing me. I can't stand no more. I can't stand no more of this third degree.
There is a haunting question raised by one of the most important books on lamentations written in the 20th century. It was written by a German Old Testament scholar by the name of Klaus Westermann. And he writes, you see, it's one thing to analyze the poems and to think about history. It's quite another to think about the suffering of the people of the Bible. And Professor Westermann, in his book, asks this simple question. Why don't Christians read the Book of Lamentations very much? He notes that the Book of Lamentations is hardly ever used in Christian liturgy. It's hardly ever used as a text in worship. It's hardly ever used as a text for a sermon. He is actually disturbed by the fact that most Christian scholars of Lamentations, they start to read about the great pain in the book, but then they rush immediately to chapter 3, which does contain some more positive praises of God as the righteous judge, and therefore seems to quickly resolve the pain raised by the rest of the book. Why, asked Professor Vestermann, is chapter 3 always called the heart of the Book of Lamentations? Is it because we want our Bible to give us a happy ending? A pleasing and pleasant message that nicely avoids human pain and suffering? And he asks us to consider, is this chapter really the full expression of lament in all the other poems? You see, some scholars, he's right, some scholars have actually downgraded the significance of even doing laments. Some Christians, starting already in the first centuries of Christianity, said that the Book of Lamentations is not worthy of Christian prayer and worship. Not worthy. Because, they thought, there are always better ways for people to be reminded about God. Or, my brothers and sisters, is it really, bottom line, because we want to look away from human suffering, especially the suffering of others, the very suffering that may call on us as well as God to act? Vestermann writes, in some, Lamentations does not arise in order to answer certain questions or resolve problems and conflicts. These songs arose as a reaction on the part of those affected by the collapse. The real significance of laments, he says, resides in the way that they allow the suffering of the afflicted to find expression. Let me read that last phrase again. The real significance, he says, of laments resides in the way that they allow the suffering of the afflicted to find expression. Vestermann, therefore, is sorry that laments are not a more central part of Christian worship and prayer. They are minimized, they are criticized, yet he powerfully states that the cry of Jesus on the cross is surely Jesus in his most deeply human moment, a moment when he is perhaps the most like us. But what about that idea of laments as protest? Brueggemann says, sufferers have been given the opportunity to pour out their hearts before God, precisely in the language of the lament. It's seen in the Old Testament as an expression of divine mercy because in the Bible, he writes, sufferers are allowed to voice their laments directly to God. So these two Old Testament scholars want us to include laments and lamentations in our worship precisely because it is an expression of human suffering, calling on God to hear. And we should not minimize or try to quickly resolve the pain that is expressed. Not all of us, brothers and sisters, are in a happy state of resolution. Some of us are in the midst of our pain. And those, brothers and sisters, need to also be heard. Their prayer is like a lamentation. Sometimes our prayers should be prayers of pain, not always happy and resolved. Sometimes we want our pain to be expressed and our pain to be heard by God and others. Sometimes it's important to remind ourselves of the pain of others, even if it's not ourselves who are suffering.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening all over this land. I'd hammer out danger. I'd hammer out a warning. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. Yeah. Oh, yeah. If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning. I'd ring it in the evening all over this land. I'd ring out danger. I'd ring out a warning. I'd ring out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. Yeah, yes, I would. Yes, I would. Now, if I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning, I'd sing it in the evening, all over this land. I'd sing out danger. I'd sing out a warning. I'd sing out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. Yeah. You know what? I've got a hammer. I've got a bell. And I've got a song that I want to sing all over this land. It's the hammer of justice. And it's the bell of freedom. And it's the song of love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land, all over this land, yeah. Hammer of justice, bell of freedom. Oh,
So how are Lamentations like the blues? How dare we compare Lamentations to music that sometimes has been called the devil's music? Why are blues called evil music? Well, there's famous stories, of course. Robert Johnson, whom some proclaim as among the greatest early artists of blues, he died as a very young man after recording only 29 songs. He was said, of course, to have made a deal with the devil at the crossroads near Clarksdale, Mississippi, so that he could play so well. And I've been to that crossroads. I'm not sure they would have had much time to talk before the traffic, but in any case. It's an often repeated story. But many African American scholars and historians are justifiably angry, I think, with the tendency, especially among white historians, to emphasize blues as evil music and overemphasize the sexualized lyrics in some blues music. John Spencer, who wrote The Blues and Evil, speaks with some anger about white historians who dwell far too much on the sexualized themes of the blues as if that's the main point. Blues as evil music, he says, and even marketing it largely to a white record-buying audience as evil music, he says, is another form of scapegoating blacks in America. Identifying blues as evil is another way of saying blacks are evil, and therefore all their behavior is evil. Spencer powerfully writes that to focus on those lyrics, the evil and the secular, denies that the blues was classically a musical form born of actual suffering. In short, to talk about bad words in lyrics so that we don't have to hear about the actual suffering in those lyrics. Now, I believe Christians should reject that kind of social stereotyping. We can enjoy and appreciate the artistry of the blues, but we should also learn how to listen to pain. After all, we've learned to listen to pain in our Bibles. Surely we can listen to others' pain as well. But there's another side to this issue, of course. There's no denying that there is some mention of sexuality and love in blues music. Spencer goes even further as a black theologian who says, look, being titillated by sexualized lyrics misses the point. Missing love, missing your man, missing your woman, is also missing the loving family that God intended us to have in this world. Most male blues singers dream of that one woman that they want in their life. Blues women sing about the man that will care for them. Well, friends, obviously what they want is stability, love, intimacy, and permanence. And blues comes from not having that. James Cone writes in his most important book, The Spirituals and the Blues, he says, the blues have to do with the structure and meaning of existence itself. They knew something was wrong. People were not created to be defined by others, and neither was it meant for a woman to be separated from her man. To read history teaches us that religious spirituals were easily as important for African American survival, but it is also true that the blues had a reputation for speaking an unvarnished, sometimes angry or sad word about daily life. Now, I don't know how many of you have been able to attend a blues concert, but there's something very interesting about listening to the blues, and I'm sure LaRonda and Ed can tell us about this. And that is, unlike any other kind of concerts, the kind of response you hear to a blues tune sounds like we're in church. Yes. Yeah. People call out, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. People call out, yes, I've lived that. So there's something about the truth being said. Now, friends, Lamentations is like that too. Lamentations demands that we see at least three times in the first chapter of the book, there is a call out to God. O Lord, look at my affliction. Look, O Lord, and see how worthless I have become. See, O Lord, how distressed I am. My stomach churns. My heart is wrung within me. Now, my friends, I don't myself enjoy the occasionally violent or abusive lyrics in some blues songs. I'm not advocating for all blues, no matter what. What I am suggesting is that we understand that most of the blues comes from the experience of violence, oppression, and suffering that could have devastating impact on what we hope to be a normal family and intimate relations. Violence and poverty also had a horrifically destructive impact on ancient Jewish life as well. If the Song of Solomon expresses and celebrates sexual love easily as racy as any blues tune, showing us the positive side of God's intended love, then the Bible shows us just as much about sadness and broken relationships, just like the blues. The prophet Micah's laments about broken family relationships is an indication that the suffering under the conquest had a horrendous impact on Hebrew life, like slavery and the broken promises of equality had on African-American life. The impact of this is visible throughout the scripture, just as it is visible throughout the blues.
Trouble in mind, but I'm blue, but I won't be blue always. You know the sun is gonna shine, it's gonna shine in my back door one day. Will y'all help me out here, give us a beat right here, come on. I'm all alone at midnight, and my lamp is burning low. And I ain't had so much trouble in my life before. Lord knows I'm trouble in mind. That's true. See, I've almost lost my mind. Life ain't worth living, no. Sometimes I feel like dying. Come on, Mr. Ed, play some blues, play some blues. To the river, and I'm gonna take my rocking chair. And if the blues don't leave me, y'all, then I'm gonna rock on away from here. Oh, trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always. You know that the sun is gonna shine in my back door one day. Yeah.
So reading the Book of Lamentations and listening to the blues reminds us that life doesn't always resolve so quickly. But there's one more thing to be said. And that is what I learned as a reader of the Bible from listening to the blues. You see, the Book of Lamentations is not the first gut-wrenching cry from that conquest that we mentioned. It's not the first sounds from the tragedy of those Babylonian soldiers marching away from the ruins of Jerusalem. The curious thing about the book is that these poems are very carefully arranged. There's been some careful thought. For example, chapters 1, 2, and 3 each have three lines, each verse has three lines, and each of those lines begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. There are 22 verses in the Hebrew alphabet. There are 22 verses in chapters 1, 2, and 3. Chapter 1, each line begins Aleph, Aleph, Aleph. Chapter 1, verse 2, each line begins Bet, Bet, Bet. In other words, ABC. Chapter 4, also, 22 verses, also, each of two lines begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Strangely, chapter 5 seems intentionally broken. Still 22 verses, but some of the letters seem to be missing. Why? Why are the poems arranged so carefully like this? Is it just a device for memory? Some have said, well, it's an expression of suffering from A to Z. Is it just rhetoric? Well, let's go back to Professor Vestermont, because he said something that I have to say at first I was shocked with. He said, maybe the ancient Hebrews just found it pleasing to read that way. And I got to tell you, my immediate reaction was to say, pleasing? Professor Vestermont, you're being a little brutal here. How could poems that deal with such suffering be pleasing at all? Pleasing to read the Book of Lamentations? These are sorrowful poems about tragic events. And now I thought he was a little heartless here to make a comment like that. But then I remembered the blues. It has become one of the most popular musical forms adopted all over the world. I have a book on my shelf called The Blues in Moscow. The subjects, of course, of the blues can be terribly painful, but pleasing? Well, yes, of course it is. Why? Is it because in the blues, pain is expressed and therefore the poet and the singer is not made to be silent and just accept it? They can protest. They can call out. In their voice, we are also invited to call out, to express pain. B.B. King famously said, sometimes life gives you the blues, but the blues always gives you life. Why does singing about sorrow reduce sorrow? When in South Africa they formed the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the point was simply to hear the stories of the suffering. Months and months of testimony from those who had lost loved ones, who had suffered themselves, or knew those who suffered. There was sometimes profound healing in just being able to tell the truth, to be heard. Psychologists tell us that telling the truth means you're in control and now have the ability to speak out. You're no longer controlled by others. But is the truth ultimately also a prayer to God? Can much of the blues be heard as prayers? To read Lamentations is like listening to the blues, brothers and sisters. We acknowledge that we suffer. We express our pain to God because we believe that God cares. We express our pain because we are God's children. One scholar of the Lamentations surprised me by arguing that Lamentations, ironically, presumes a very intimate relationship with God because you trust most the ones with whom you are so brutally honest. To lament presumes trust. Maybe that's why we love the blues. Expressing pain reminds us that pain is not proper, it is not good, and it is not the right way. We express our pain because we want life to be better, to be more just, to be more joyful. Sometimes we read Lamentations because we are suffering, but sometimes we listen and say a prayer for the suffering of others. The blues reminds us that we have suffered, that others suffer, but we have the right to call on God, and we have the right to call on each other. As Christians, we can enjoy the blues not because that's how life always is, but because we have the right to call out to God our pain and the pain of others. We admit we can have the blues. We can lament because we know there is someone who cares, who listens. It isn't that we enjoy the suffering. It's that we have a God who wants to hear the truth and hear us.
Boy, going to go into my blues gigs now with new fervor. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So we invite you, if you know this song, and if you'd like to actually stand with us, and we'll sing Jesus Is on the Main Line together. Yes? All right. You've already proven to be great clappers, so let's do it together. Come on, Mr. Ed. Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. Oh, Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. Yeah. Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. You ought to call him up and tell him what you want. Now you got it. Sing it with me now. Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. Oh, Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. You ought to call him up and tell him what you want. Oh. If you're sick and you can't get well, y'all, tell him what you want. Oh, if you're sick and you can't get well, tell him what you want. Yeah. If you're sick and you can't get well, tell him what you want. You ought to call him up and tell him what you want. Yeah. Call him up, call him up, tell him what you want. Oh, call him up, call him up, tell him what you want. Call him up, call him up, tell him what you want. You ought to call him up and tell him. And we're going to sing it through one more time. Jesus, Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want, yeah. Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. Create your own lamentation. Jesus is on the main line. Tell him what you want. You ought to call him up and tell him what you want. Yes. Yes. Bless you.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, LaRonda. Thank you, Reedwood Friends Church. Come and greet our visitors. Visit with each other. There are CDs available out there. There is also some reception. And Reedwood is famous for hospitality. So if you are visiting today, introduce yourselves to virtually anyone around you, and you'll have a sample of that. Thank you very much for this morning, ladies and gentlemen. Go and serve God this week. Amen.